All right, welcome to Walkthrough 3. Thank you for coming out on this holiday. We've got quite a number of people here if you're watching the video. So next time, when it's a holiday, please do come. So we're going to talk about problem set 3 today, and it's called the Game of 15. Is everyone familiar with the concept of the Game of 15? What kind of game it is? You know, the plastic toy, the really cheap toy that you can... With the tiles, and you can move around the numbers, and when you arrange them from 1 to the number of tiles minus 1, you've won. So that's basically the point of the Game of 15. If you aren't familiar with it, then Wikipedia does have an entry on it with some images that we've used in the problem set. Okay, so, one thing. Thank you for completing the walkthrough survey. If you haven't completed it yet, there's a link on the second page of the problem set at the bottom telling you to go to the survey, so please do complete it. It's about the walkthrough, and I really want your input on how I'm doing and what I can improve, what materials you want me to cover, because, as always, my goal is for you to go home knowing how to do the problem set, and if I haven't really done that, then there's really no point of me coming here every week. So please do fill out that survey, and I guess we'll cover the material. Okay, so step 0 in the problem set is SSHing to nice again. This will be probably the last time that you'll SSH to nice, because we've set up our own cluster, cloud.cs50.net, that the Hacker Edition people have been using. The new cluster is sort of nice in the sense that it's got a lot of resources. We can use the entire server space for our purposes. And it's also, it's cool to be doing this cloud computing thing that people are talking about. Okay, so we're going to use this not-so-cool nice today to copy over the distribution of the problem set. Now, this is a first, because so far in CS50, we haven't been giving you any distributions of any source code to complete the problem set. But this time, we're going to distribute some frameworks for you to build upon to complete the problem set. And so this time, we need you to copy some files from the CS50 home directory first. And how are we going to do that? Well, we simply use the commands that are listed in the problem set. So have all of you completed that step? Is everyone familiar with the Unix command for copy? OK, what's the Unix command for copy?
CP.
And the an argument here, which is, the argument we're using here is hyphen R, and R stands for recursive. It means go through every directory that we're copying and copy everything that's inside those directories as well. So in Windows, you don't really come across the concept of a recursive copy, because when you copy a folder, everything copies over too. But in Unix, a directory is just like a file. So, that's sort of a white lie, but when you copy a directory, then you also have to specify this R command. And it's also true for some other commands that require this recursive argument. Okay, so let's say we've just copied over the code. That was CPR CS50 pub distributions PSET3, and then we'll copy that into our own home directory. So just to be precise, what we're doing is we're copying from the CS50, which is a user on the nice servers, CS50 pub distributions PSET3, that's a folder inside our home directory, and then we're copying that into our own home directory. So let's say I wasn't CS50 right now, but I was myself. I would be copying that into my own home directory. Does anyone have any questions about this? Because I know on the survey some people were a bit confused about the Unix commands, and I don't want to get anyone confused. Okay. All right, so now we've got that done. We want to take a look inside the distribution to see what's there. So we'll go in. PSET3. So remember, the CD is change directory. It lets us get into the directory. And then ls to list the contents of the directory. And you see here that we have 15, which is the Game of 15 source code that I talked about. And find, which is the first step in our problem set. And questions.txt, which is a text file that you'll write to answer the questions that are in the problem set. Okay, so first, once we're in this directory, what we want to do is to try compiling the programs that are in here. Of course, not everything is implemented inside 15 and find. These contain a bunch of C files and H files, which are header files. Is everyone familiar with what header files are? Yeah? No? Okay, so header files are just like C files, C being source code files, but header files let you define functions before you actually write out what they actually do. So for example, if you are writing the function that says, that prints foo to the screen, then you might call the function foo. But instead of implementing the whole source code with the printf statement in the .h file, you'll just write, for example, void foo parentheses in the .h file to define that function. And then in the C file, you'll just go ahead and actually implement that function. Okay? Does that make it clear? Okay. So we'll go inside the 15 directory first. No, actually, we'll go through the find directory first. And sorry, that was not what I was going to do. So find is a Unix command that lets you go through directories finding files. So I just inadvertently executed that instead of going inside the find directory. But so we're inside the find directory now, and then I've listed it. So you can see here we have a bunch of files, find.c, generate.c, helpers.c, helpers.h, and something called a makefile. So to explain each of these, find.c is our find program, which is described in the problem set. And generate.c is also another program described in the problem set. And helpers.c is a program, or it's a file used by the other .c files, find.c and generate.c, to define some helper functions. So these are functions that you'll use in more than one location in your code. So instead of defining each of the functions in your find.c and generate.c and duplicating that effort, you just put them in a file called helpers.c, and that helps consolidate the same code into one file. Does that make sense? Yeah. So this is actually a commonly used technique, because you really don't want to have the same code in two places. One, because it wastes disk space and it wastes compilation time, and also because if you make a bug in one version of the code, and then you find that you have to change it, you have to also change it in two or more locations, and it's much easier to just have one file that does everything. Okay. And helpers.h is the header file of helpers.c that I just described. Helpers.h defines some things that are actually implemented in helpers.c. And when we look inside the files, we'll see exactly what that means. And the makefile is also something that's new to this problem set. We'll also discuss that when we discuss the makefile. Okay. So first, let's see. Okay, so we're going to look at generate first. So generate.c is a program that David has written. It's already fully implemented. The only thing it's missing is comments if you see the /// to do sections. These are comments that you have to provide as part of the problem set. But besides that, the whole code is implemented, so you don't need to worry about actually implementing it. But you do need to understand what it's actually doing, because to comment the code, you really have to know what the code is doing. So what does this code do? Have you guys taken a look at what it does? So it's pretty short. It fits on one terminal window, which is nice. What is it first doing there in the first to do? It uses argc and argv. Or rather, it uses argc and argv. Any? Yeah?
Make sure that there's either two or three command line arguments. Mm-hmm. And if there's not, then it gives the right format.
Yeah, that's right. So it's basically just checking that the usage of the user is correct. Usage is a term meaning how the user executes the command. So it's checking that the arguments are correct. And it's doing a bunch of things. I won't elaborate, because that's part of the problem set. So it's using A to I, which I discussed in the previous walkthrough. And then it's using these functions srand and rand. So if you've the problem set describes in pretty good detail what those functions do, but rand is basically the C pseudo-random number generator. And why is it pseudo-random? Why can't it just be random?
Because
Shen.
Computers do what they're told, so they can't just make up a random number. You have to like tell them how to come up with a number, so mm-hmm. it's not really random.
Right, yeah. So computers can only do what you tell them to do. So if you can't just write a program that says, just choose for me. Because programs have to know exactly what they're doing. So pseudorandom takes into account pseudorandom number generators, PRNGs, take into account a certain seed, a number that it bases all its calculations on. So if you have the same seed and use the random number generator multiple times, then you'll end up with the same series of numbers coming out of that pseudorandom number generator. Okay. So. So what SRAND does is it seeds the random number generator. That's why it's called SRAND. So we see here that in one case it's assigning one of the arguments as the seed, and in the other case it's using the current time as a seed. And then we see that it's just printing out a bunch of random numbers using the RAND function. Okay. So let's see what it actually does. But we have to compile it first. So the bad news is David actually just removed some aliases that made your life easier. You can't just type gcc generate.c anymore. You have to type out all the arguments that were being magically typed out for you. And those arguments are gcc ggdb, standard equals c99, warnings all, and output is called generate, and the input is generate.c. So it's a really long command line, and I didn't remember. I just read it off the problem set. So as I said, this is standard is C99 because we're going to use C99 standards. Does everyone remember what the differences between old C and C99 were? What was one of the differences? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in a function, you can specify variables at any time. You don't need to define them at the top of the function as in old C, but you can define them anywhere in the function, even in for loops. And as I said, W all is warnings all, so it displays all your warnings. So if GCC says thinks that you've made some kind of mistake, then it will tell you. And then GGDB means you can use GDB, which is the GNU debugger, with this program. And I think David went over using GDB in lecture, is that right? Briefly, okay. So I don't know if we'll have time to go over GDB, but there are some really nice tutorials. If you look on the resources page of the course website, there were some broken links, but they're fixed now. If you go there, you'll see some nice tutorials that you can go over to learn GDB. And if you have any questions, do feel free to use the forum, which is being used by a lot of people. We're getting a lot of posts on that. And also office hours, which are, there are so many office hours, you can't even count them. Anyway, GCC GGDB, standard equals C99, warnings all, output generate. Now, do you remember this from the first week, or the second week, was it? This is specifying the output file name. So we'll call our program generate, and this is just the input file, generate.c, which is the name of the C program that we just looked at. Okay, so if we run this, hopefully it'll compile. Yep, it did. And then we can run generate. Okay, so it's telling me that the usage is generate NS. So what does this mean? Yep. Mm-hmm, yeah, so N, where N is, we have to specify a number of, so how many pseudo random numbers do we want? So if you write generate 10, then it'll come up with 10 pseudo-random numbers. And what is the S in brackets? If you've read the problem set, it's... Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly right. It's where you put in the seed. So if you don't want the pseudo-random number generator to use the current time as the seed, then you can specify your own seed in the second argument here in brackets. So why is it in brackets? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. If you don't provide S, then it'll just use the current time. So it's a convention that's used in pretty much every other Unix program out there. If an argument is in brackets, then it means that it's optional, that you don't need to supply it in certain cases. So, and it doesn't mean that you specified the argument in brackets. It means that you just, it's optional. It's, so for example, I could say generate 10. I haven't specified the optional argument there. Or I could specify generate 5. Oh, sorry, generate 10, 5. And then it would use 5 as the seed and generate 10 numbers. And as I mentioned earlier, if you use the same seed, it's actually not random. It's only pseudo-random. So if you use the same seed, then every time you run the program, it's going to come up with the same random numbers. Okay. And notice that I didn't write the square brackets here. Okay. So with that done, so I mentioned the GCC command that we're using, the really long one. Now, instead of doing this, we can actually shorten our commands. And we've done exactly that in the problem set. So instead of typing this GCC command out every time that you want to compile this program, which might be several times if you're debugging a really long program, then you can actually use something called GNU make. And what it does is it reads in a file called the make file, which we saw that existed in this directory. And then it goes through the make file and then reads in commands that tell it what to do when certain commands are issued. So we'll actually use make here. So instead of writing GCC, we can write make generate. And it tells me generate is up to date. Well, let's make sure generate is not up to date by deleting it. And you can see here that this command that make executed and the command that we were executing above is the same. So what make does is it basically goes through the make file, and inside the make file, as we'll see, it contains the command that I just typed above. So we'll look at the make file. Okay, so this might look a little complicated at first, but it's just a type of configuration file. It's actually pretty simple. So if we just look at the generate section, we see generate colon generate dot c, and then the command that we just executed. So it's basically like a bunch of aliases for what we want to do. So if when I type make generate, it'll go through the file, find generate colon, and then it'll execute the command that's in purple right there. So you also find that there are other targets in the file. So generate is a target, find is a target, and clean and all are also targets. So what a target is basically the second argument after make. So if I type make generate, it'll go there. If I type make find, it'll go to the find section. Okay. So it's just a bunch of aliases. It's not something to be worried about. One thing that you do need to remember is that the make file actually has to the space here is actually not a bunch of spaces but a tab, and if you don't write a tab here, make will fail with a cryptic error message. So do remember that this has to be a tab. Okay. All right. So another thing, make all. Oops, sorry. Make all is a special target because it doesn't specify an argument in purple. What it does is it does make find, and then it does make generate. So it's like two aliases put together. So if you type make all, it'll make all the programs in the current directory. It's also a Unix convention. And make clean is a special one here. Instead of compiling, you see here it uses the rm command. And what is the rm command? It removes files. So it deletes... what does it delete? It deletes a bunch of things. What's one thing that it deletes? It deletes a dot out. And what else? There's an infinite number of things that it could delete. And why is that? Does anyone know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything that ends with a dot O. So the asterisk is a wild card. It anything that matches something dot O will get deleted. A dot out, core, find, and generate are all files that will be deleted by the rm command. And RMF, does anyone know what RMF is? RMF, the argument there. Does anyone know? Okay, so it's actually, F stands for force, so it forces the deletion. And why that we need that is because David has set up some files. When you ran CS50 setup, it made sure that when you tried to delete a file, so for example, if you typed rm core, it won't just delete the file. It'll tell you, are you sure you want to delete this file? And then only when you type y or yes will it allow you to delete the file. And that's actually non-standard behavior because rm will just, it'll just delete your files if you don't specify anything like that. So CS50 setup might have saved you from like some inadvertent deletions. It definitely has for me. So what it does is override that, and it says, just go ahead and delete anything that matches those files. So David asks in the problem set one question, why would you not want to have rmf asterisk dot c in that command? Yeah, because .c files contain code, so you wouldn't want to delete all your code when you type make clean. Because make clean isn't a remove everything in directory command. It's just delete everything that was generated by the GCC compiler and everything that could potentially be regenerated. Okay, so if you want to submit your program and you don't want DTF to see all the dirty binaries and core dumps that you've made, just type make clean and then submit the file, the problem set, and all those files will be deleted. Okay, any questions? Okay. So we've yet to get to the interesting part of the problem set. Okay, so... Oops. So that was generate. And everyone's now familiar with what generate does? Okay, no questions? Okay, so the next file that we'll be looking at is this other one called find.c. And this one is a tad bit more interesting. And what does it do? Can anyone tell me what it does? What does find do?
It will search for the value that you input.
Yeah. So find, what it does is it searches through a bunch of inputs that you've provided to it, and then find something that you've... So when you run find, you have to specify what you want it to find. So for example, if I type find 5, it'll try to find 5 in the list that you provide after you start running the program. So let's actually run the program. So find 5. So haystack 0. So what is this haystack and needle thing? Does anyone know why it's called a haystack and a needle? Yeah, so it actually comes, yeah, so that's right. You have to go through the haystack to find a needle from that haystack. And it comes from the phrase to find a needle in a haystack, of course. So what we're doing is going through the haystack looking for needles. And it's actually a common name used in programming to find a needle in a haystack. So anyway, so what was the needle in this case? 5, yeah. So 5 was the needle, and then we have to provide the haystack. So let's provide a bunch of random numbers. Whoops. So what did it do there? What did I do wrong? Yeah, so I typed W34, which is not a number. So it told me to enter a new one. Okay, so I've provided a bunch of numbers for the haystack. And how do I get out of this? I don't want... Yeah, control D. So I don't want to provide any more numbers, so I want to tell it that I'm finished. So control D is actually a special control character in this environment. What does control D send? It sends a character. Yeah, so control D is actually end of file. So in any file that that you read in, for example, with C, at the end you'll see a character, or it's actually not a character, but a sort of like a faux character, a pseudo character. So EOF signals the end of the file. So what we want to do here is manually send the end of file character, control D, and then found needle in haystack, because as you can see, I provided 5 in the in haystack 1. Okay, so now we see what the program does. Why is it useful? Why is it useful at all to have this program? Any thoughts? Yeah?
Well, I guess if you had multiple lists of numbers and you were looking for a certain number, mm-hmm. use it.
Yeah, that's right. If you were looking for a certain number in a long list of numbers, then you could find it, which is what the program does. It's actually useful not because you can type in each of the numbers manually, because that's useless, right? You could just go through each of the numbers if you were typing them anyway. But why it's useful is because you can actually pipe a file into this program. So did David mention what piping was in Lectra? No? Okay. So there are about 3 types of piping. Well, there are more types of piping, but we'll discuss 3 types of piping in the in this problem set. What piping is that it allows you to pipe. A pipe is a pipe, right? So let's say we have one program and another program here. So we can actually create a pipe between these two programs and send data over that pipe to the other program. What we can also do is have a file and pipe that file into a program. And we can also have a program and a file and pipe the output of the program to the pipe to the file. Okay, let me draw that if it helps any. So let's say we have a program and then a file. So we can send it to the send a program to a file. Sorry, send the data from a program to a file. We can also send the contents of a file to a program, and we can also send data from a program to another program. Which one would be useful in this context? If we had a long list of numbers that we wanted to search through, which paradigm would we want to use?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if we wanted to use the output of generate to find, then we'd want to use this one because we're piping from a program to another program, from generate to find. But if we had a long list of numbers that we wanted to send for sorting, then we'd want to use this one, from a file to a pipe, to a program. Okay, so this file pipe business is really confusing. So I'll show you how it's actually done. So let's say we want to create a file, a long list of numbers. We'll call that listNums. Okay, and then we'll just we'll create a list of numbers, and then we can send listNums. Find. Let's say we're looking for the number 5 again. Find 5 listNums. Okay. Okay. So what I've done here is I specified find 5 smaller than listNums. What this does is it sends the contents of the file listNums to the file. Okay, does that make sense? So the way the angle bracket is pointing is the way that we want to send the file. So we're sending from listNums to find 5. And what it's done, why it's displaying this is because I presumably specified 16 numbers. And the 17th number, it says retry. What happened there? I didn't hit Control D because there was no Control D in the file, but there was a. There was an end of file at the end of the file, of course. So the program quit. So it's basically doing the same thing as typing everything manually, but instead of typing everything manually on the. Into the program, what we've done is just piped a file into the program. Okay? And we'll use this when we're debugging the game of 15, so it's a useful trick to know. And So what were the other types of piping? There was also piping from a program to a program. So if we wanted to generate 10 pseudo-random numbers and then pipe that to find 5, we use this one, which is slightly different, essentially the same concept. Here we're using a pipe character instead. So this this vertical line is called a pipe. Ironically, not so ironically, it's just because it does a pipe, that's why it's called a pipe character. So it's piping the output of generate 10 into find 5. Okay? Is that clear? Is good? So why don't we use an angle bracket? I don't know. It's presumably because it's difficult to tell whether generate is a file, if you want to pipe the contents of generate into find, or if you want to pipe the output. So we provide the pipe character, the vertical line, for piping from programs to programs. So the other one was piping from a program to a file, that is saving the output of a program to a file. So for example, if we wanted to to create a file listing 100 pseudorandom numbers, then we can write generate 100, and then an angle bracket pointing towards away from the generate program to output.txt. What this does is it runs generate with the argument 100, and then it pipes the output of the program to output.txt. So what it does is basically, it's the same as copying the contents of the output and then pasting it into a file. So if we open output.txt, you can see that we have the list of 100 pseudorandom numbers. Okay, and as I showed earlier, you can pipe that into find if you want by using the other pipe character, the angle bracket pointing towards find and output.txt. So it didn't find needle in haystack. Apparently, our list of 100 numbers didn't contain the number 5. Okay, do you have any questions about this piping business? Yep.
Yeah, so within the generate program, I assume there must be a lot of variables, but how does the program know which one is the output, which one is
it? Oh, so which one is the output and which one is the input? Okay. I see. So the question was, how does every program know how to how to get the input and how to get the output? Is that your question?
Or
what was the input and what was the output? So basically, there are a number of pseudo files in Unix called standardin, and standardout, and there's also another one called standarderror. You don't need to worry about that. But what it does is when you say get int, what the CS50 library is doing is going to standard in and asking, are there any characters coming in from standard in? And what printf is doing when it's outputting data is saying, write these characters to standard out.
Okay, so whatever it's print, whatever you declare with printf, it's whatever it's output.
Yeah, so whatever you output with printf is what is piped to the other program. Yeah, good question. Any questions? Any more questions? Okay. So this, it's still not very interesting. I can see many of you falling asleep. So it's, unfortunately, it still doesn't get very interesting. Now we're going to check in and check out files. And what does this mean? What do I mean by checking in and checking out files? Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you check in a file, you save it to some backup. And then when you check out a program, you can restore that backup. So it's basically a backup and restore system. And it's really useful because, as you've probably noticed while doing problem set 1 and 2, it's really easy to make a mistake in your program and then only realize hours later that you've made that mistake. And then by that time, that data is gone. So what you want is make a backup every hour or every time you make a significant change, you want to check in that current version of the file. It's like, has anyone edited Wikipedia before? Or any wiki? No? You have? So what Wikipedia does is it saves every old version of every article, right? So why does it do that? I mean, we could just have one new version, right? Why waste all this disk space being saving all these old files? Yeah?
Well,
Yeah. So what often happens on Wikipedia is that people delete entire articles called page blanking, and they insert swear words. They say someone is something, or insert your favorite swear word there, and basically do all sorts of nuisance to the article. And if you don't have those old versions, then you're really stuck with the new version, and you don't know what was there before the vandalism. So what you want to do is to go back to the old version and then restore that from the backup. So that's what Wikipedia's wiki system allows you to do. And it's really the same concept here, checking in and checking out. If you check in a file, then it's saved to the backup. And when you check out, it's restored from the backup. So how do we do this? It's actually really simple, because there are two commands in our environment that we can use called CI and CO. So let's say I want to backup the contents of the listeners file. I mean, it's not very important, but let's say it was really important, so we wanted to back it up. So I can check it in by typing CI and then the name of the file, CI listnums. This would check in listnums, okay? And then I hit enter, and it says, enter description terminated with single dot or end of file. So it's actually the first time that we're checking in this listnums file. CI doesn't know about this file. So what it's doing is asking us to provide a description of this file. So what we can do is type a description, for example, this is my list of numbers. And then, as it tells us, we can write multiple lines. Once we've done with the description, to save that, we just type a single dot and then press enter. And as you can see here, it says done. So presumably it's saved the file to its backup. So what it says here, initial revision 1.1, means that the version we just saved is now called version 1.1 of listnums. Okay? So what it's doing is saving a version number for each version of the file that we're checking in. So once we've checked that out, we can also check it out saying CO listnums. You can provide CO with a version argument, which is CO hyphen R and the version number. For example, if we want to check out version 1.1, we can say hyphen R 1.1 find.c or listnums. But in this case, I didn't type a hyphen R argument. So it's checking out the latest copy from the backup, which might not be what you want to do, because if you've saved an older copy and you want to return to that, then you want to specify a version number. So let's say, let's change list nums. Let's say we don't want the number 5 here, so we're going to change it to the number 50. And then we can say CI list nums again. And now you can see that CI now knows that this is a newer version of a file that's already been checked in. It says newer version 1.2. And the previous version was 1.1. Remember, that was the first version that we checked in. So it says enter log message. And this is really important, more important than the description, because what it allows you to do is to type in English what changes you made between the previous version and the current version. So what I did was change number 5 to number 50. So I can type this, and then again, I type a single dot when I want to terminate the description. And then it's checked in version 1.2 of our listnums file. Now let's say I want to go back to the previous version of listnums. Let's say I don't want the number 50 anymore, I want number 5. What I can do is check out the old version of the file. So remember that the older version of the file was version 1.1. So we can use CO, check out, with the version argument, hyphen R 1.1. You can see here that there's no space between hyphen R and 1.1. Okay. And then we specify the file name, listnums. And then it says, writable list nums exists, remove it. Why is it asking this? Have I done something wrong? No? Why is it asking me to? Yeah, to make sure I really want to overwrite this file, because list nums already exists as the current version, and we want to overwrite with the newer version. So I type yes. And then if we go into list nums again, you can see that the older version with the 5 has been restored. Great. Okay, so this is really useful when you want to save backups of your C files, and I really recommend it because you really won't know what you did 5 hours ago when it's 3 a.m. in the morning. Okay, and what you can also do is to see a log of all the versions of your file. So if I type rlog listnums, which was the file that we want to look at the log for, you can see here that, so this is the description of the file, the one I typed when I was checking in the first version of the file. And then this is the difference description between the version 1.1 and version 1.2. So basically what we entered when we did the second check-in. Okay? So if we do more check-ins, then we'll see more descriptions here. So what rlog does is it tells you what changes you've made, and hopefully if you've been backing up frequently, you'll be able to go back to the version that you want. So it's really important to specify a nice description here and a nice difference description here, because if you don't, then you really won't know what you're doing. Okay? Do you have any questions about CI, CO, and rlog? Okay. All right, so at last we'll... okay, so we'll take a quick break here and then go back to... and then start the game of 15 and sorting and searching. Okay. Okay, welcome back. How's the break? Good? Same trick from last time. Okay. So there are two things that we have to do before implementing the game of 15 in this problem set, and that is we have to implement two functions in helpers.c. One of them is to re-implement the search function in helpers.c as a binary search, and to actually implement the sort function at the bottom of helpers.c. So the problem set tells us that we have to write sort using an O of n squared algorithm. So what is an O of n squared algorithm? Can anyone tell me why? What is it, what it is?
Polynomial.
Yeah, so O of n squared algorithm is actually an algorithm that runs in polynomial time. So what is an example of such an algorithm? Yeah, bubble sort is a good example of an algorithm that runs in O of n squared time. And insertion sort is also a very simple to implement, if rather inefficient algorithm to use for O of n squared time. And so you don't actually need to choose an algorithm that's exactly O of n squared, because anything that is better than O of n squared, for example, an algorithm that runs in O of n time, is also technically in O of n squared time, right? So we can use any kind of sort algorithm. And I won't actually go over the algorithm in the walkthrough because it's fairly trivial to convert from pseudocode, for example, in David's lecture notes, into actual C code. So it might take you a few minutes or an hour maybe to go through the algorithm looking for details and figuring out what everything does. But once you've done that, then it shouldn't take too long to convert that into C code. So is that okay? Can I just go ahead? Okay. So sort. I'm going to sort all the numbers that come in through the values array, and n is the number of elements in that array. And why do we have to provide this? Why do I have to provide the number of elements when I'm providing the array itself in the function? Can the function not figure out for itself what n is? Any ideas? No? Okay, it's actually because there's no way in C to find out how long an array is if it's not been explicitly defined. So in this case, since we have values open square brackets, close square brackets, we don't know how long the values array is. We have to actually tell the function how long it is. So in other programming languages, there might be a function called count, which will tell you how long an array is, but not in C. In C, you have to know how long an array is to actually stop reading an array at the right position. And that's because arrays are implemented with something called pointers, which will be covered in, I think, 1 or 2 weeks. So basically, that's the sort function. Any questions there? No? Okay. Oh, and besides David's lectures, you can also look at the Absolute Beginner's Guide to C book, which was one of the recommended books for this course. And if you don't have that book, you can also look on the internet. But make sure that you don't look at the C code, because it's really easy to stumble upon the C code instead of the pseudocode. So you might want to put the word pseudocode in your Google search. Just a heads up there, because I've done the same mistake many times, but not used the C code or anything. Okay, so the search function is already implemented. What kind of search is this? Is it a good search or is it a bad search? Yeah, it's a terrible search. It goes through each and every one of the elements in the array looking for the number. It's like if I wanted to find someone in the seats in this auditorium, I would have to just go through each of the seats in the auditorium. And we know that that's not a very effective way to search. So this is a linear search, and it runs in what time? Pardon? N, yeah, it runs in O of N time because it goes through each of the elements, and N is the number of elements in the array. So we can do better than that. We can implement binary search. So again, this is something that you can look up either in the lecture notes, in the book, or online, perhaps. And it's actually much simpler than the sort function, because binary search is... did everyone go to lecture when David ripped up the directory? It's basically that concept. You're just ripping up the... So you're not ripping up anything, but basically you have two thumbs, or two fingers. So let's say this is our imaginary array. And then let's say we have a number that I guess is here. And we want to find where that number is in the array. So we go looking for it. So this is the middle of our array. And this is our imaginary number that we want to look for. So we have the middle and then the beginning. So we ask ourselves, is the number between the beginning and the middle? And if it is, then it's right here, right? So we can move the end finger here. So now the middle is here. And now we can ask ourselves, is the number between the middle, the current middle, and the current end? And it is. And we can keep on doing that until we find it. And so it's going to take a long time, but it'll still find it. Well, it won't take as long as linear search. Basically the same thing if the number was over here. We'd ask ourselves, is the number bigger than this? And if it is, then we'll move our finger here. Okay? Did that make sense? Okay. So binary search, it's really easy to implement using C. That shouldn't take too long. So any questions about search and sort? Okay. And one thing. The reason why sort isn't implemented and the program still works is because why? Remember, we're using this program, this helpers.c file in find, and find calls search and sort. Why does it still work without sorting? It's because of the search we use. Because linear search doesn't require that the array be sorted. But binary search does, right? Because we're, a directory is alphabetically organized. The imaginary array that I was describing here was numerically organized. So that's why we have to implement sort if we want to change search into a binary search. Okay. And one of the questions that you'll ponder on in the problem set is why implementing the sort and then the binary search is actually slower than what we had originally. Okay. Does anyone have any questions? Can I go on to the game of 15? Okay. All right. So the game of 15. So we have a make file again. This just means that we can type make 15 to compile the game of 15. And make clean again also cleans the extraneous files that we've created using GCC. Okay, so that's not interesting. Okay, so there are a lot of the functions in 15 are already implemented. It is already quite long. It's 200 lines of code, and it. It defines a number of functions that allow the game of 15 to work. So there are four functions that we have to implement. There's init, which is the initialization function. There's draw, which actually draws the table onto the screen. And then move, which moves a tile. and then one, which asks the program whether the user has one in the current state. So we'll see what it actually does by looking at the solutions on nice.fast. So, okay. They're in CS50, pub, solutions, PSET 3, 15. Okay. So welcome to the game of 15. And then it tells us to give us, it gives us this usage screen. So what is it looking for? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another variable after it. It's called D, so we'll assume that D means a number because that's what it is in printf. So let's provide a number. Oh, so it was actually the length of the board, the width and height of the board. So board must be between 3 and 3, 3 times 3 and 9 times 9 inclusive. So let's say we want a huge board that is 9 wide and 9 high. So we can see here that this is a game of 15 board, albeit without the nice border around it. So basically, each of these numbers represents a tile that we can move. And here we can see this underscore character, which represents the empty tile. Because in the game of 15, obviously there has to be one empty tile for things to move around, because you can't just yank things off the board. So this is a graphical representation of the game of 15. And the function that does this is the draw function. So we've got an internal representation of the board and each of the numbers in our program. It's actually represented as a 2D array. And draw basically takes that 2D array and then goes through each of the tiles, printing out the numbers in that kind of fashion. So it uses skills that you picked up on Mario in the last problem set, because remember Mario went through each of the pixels of the screen and then printed out an asterisk where there was a block and a space where there wasn't. So it's the same idea, right? Instead of blocks, it's printing out numbers this time. Okay, so do you guys all know have an idea of how you might implement draw? Yeah? Any questions? No? Okay. So I said that the tiles were represented as a 2D array. What is a 2D array? Any ideas? What is a 1D array? A one-dimensional array? It's just a line of elements. So a 2D array is basically like that. It's a representation of a table of sorts. So there are rows and there are columns, rows and columns. Okay. So if we look at the code, we can see here that the board of numbers is defined on line 33 here. Int board dim max dim max, and dim max is the constants that are defined right here. Okay, so if you remember from a couple of problem sets ago, the hash sign and define, and then a constant defines a constant with a specific variable, and we can use that anywhere in the program. Okay. So we've defined that board, int board dim max dim max. That means that this is a two-dimensional array that is, so if this is our array, this is a 1D array that is dim max wide. And then this is, so it also has a number of these. It has dim max number of arrays that go down. And it's a 2D array. Okay, so like a spreadsheet. Okay, so how can you... so this is basically in all of the functions that you'll implement, you'll have to go over each of the tiles in the program, in the board, How can you do that? Pardon? Loop? Yeah. So you can loop through each of the tiles. But can we just use one loop? Or how do we loop through each of the tiles? Yep.
You can use two loops, thinking about like go through the rows and you can go through all the columns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So instead of having one for loop, we can have two for loops. One that goes through the row, so for I equals 0, blah, blah, blah. And then another one inside that. Sorry, let me take that back. So there's one for loop that's outside, which goes through each of the rows. So for I being I 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then another loop inside that, which goes from left to right. For j equals 0 to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So basically what we're doing is going like that. It's the same technique that we used in Mario. Okay? Any confusion about that? No? Okay. So that's, as I said, it's actually this two-loop business you can actually use in all of the functions that we implement. So the first function that we implement was init, initialize. And that initializes the tiles to appropriate starting positions. And what should the init function do? How can I... So the starting position is the one that's displayed, that's shown in the problem set on page 10. Under step 12, you can see here you see here the tiles that start with 15, 14, 13, 12, and then go down to 1 and 2. Yeah. As David explains here, if the board contains an odd number of tiles, i.e. if the height and width are even, then you have to swap these bottom two, or the board isn't solvable. Okay. So that's why we have 3, 1, 2. So if we had five tiles, five for height and five for width, then we'd have 3, 2, 1. Okay? Does that make sense? Is that okay? Okay. So this is the starting position, and how do we... So the array starts off blank, right? Because we haven't defined anything in the array. Okay? So how do we define all of the elements of that array? How do we define the starting position? Well, we use the two loops that we discussed. And what will we do inside the loop? Any ideas? Well, I mean, this is just like 15, 14, 13. So it's decrementing some kind of number, right? It's a counter that goes from 15, in this case, downwards. Okay? So what we're doing inside the two loops, inside the innermost loop, what we're doing is decrementing a counter and then using the value, the current value of that counter, and putting that into the tile. So how can we put? So if this direction were I, so our loop, if this direction were I, and if this direction were j, how would we put in? So let's say this is our board. Let me draw that. If we had a board, and then, so this way is I. And this way is j. No, sorry. This way is I, and this way is j. Then, and we had to access this board. How would we access it? Pardon? With the brackets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would be... Yeah, it would be 1, 1 in this image. But let's say we're using the values I and j because we're looping around all the loops. I mean, all the tiles. What would go in here? So recall that this is I and this is j. Pardon? Yeah, I would go first, yeah. So board I and then j here, right? So what we're doing is we have two for loops. Let's see if there's an example of one in here. No, there isn't. But so inside the two for loops, what we're doing is accessing board ij and then saying board ij equals the value of the number that we want to insert. Is that good? Because this is what we'll use in each of the four functions that we define. Okay? All right, so does everyone have a grasp of what init would do? Stop me if you don't. Okay. What would draw do? Init was the... Yeah, putting in all the numbers in order of the starting position. And draw, does everyone understand what draw would do? It uses a similar concept. It goes through each of the tiles using two for loops and then accessing board ij. Do you know what? Does everyone have any questions about draw? Can I just go on, or?
Can you say it again?
Okay, so what draw would do is, so we have an internal representation of the board in board, right? So what this would do, what draw would do, would be to draw the board using the same technique that we used in Mario. It would use the two for loops again. But inside the two for loops, so what would it do? So after each of the loops that goes to the end of the line, so after j, so let me draw this. So let's say we have two for loops for the one that goes around I and then the one that goes around j. So if I wanted to draw a new line after each new line of the board, where would I insert the new line character? Where would I insert it? Here? Is that good? Here? Or here? Okay, so I'd actually insert it in the blue spot there, because for I is looping over each of the rows, right? And j is going through each of the columns in our row. So once we've ended the line, we want to draw a new line there, in the blue spot there, to draw a new line. Is that clear? Does everyone know why I'm inserting a new line? Yeah? So what we're doing is basically drawing a representation of the board. And if you get confused, what you can do is inside the innermost for loop, just write a printf statement saying printf %d board ij. And then it'll print out all of your tiles in one line. So then you can figure out where you might want to insert some characters to make it look pretty. Okay? So that's if you get stuck. Okay? Okay, so we've done init, we've done draw, and then there's move, and then there's one. What does move do? So move actually takes a number of arguments, or it takes one argument actually. Move int tile. So tile would be the number of the tile that we want to move. So each tile conveniently has a number. So if we want to move the tile that says 15, then we can say move 15. Now why do we only have one argument? I mean, if you're implementing a chess program, then you might have two places for the source and the destination, right? But why can we only have one argument? Why is it? Yeah. That's right, yeah. So every tile, so if a tile has an empty spot next to it, it can only move to that spot. It can't move anywhere else. So we only need to specify the name of the tile to move it. So what do we first want to do? So what does the description say? If tile borders empty space, moves tile and returns true, else returns false. So that part, if tile borders empty space, seems to be one of the things that we have to implement. How can we check to see if the tile borders an empty space? Check if it's null. So yes, we can check to see if a particular tile that we know the location of a tile, we can check to see if it is empty by checking for null or zero or whatever you defined the empty tile to be when you wrote the init function. Okay, so one thing I forgot to mention was that in the init function, so in you have all these filled tiles, but you also have one empty tile. And so you have to figure out for yourself what you want to call your empty tile. And that could be zero, it could be null, it could be anything. That's not difficult. But so init also needs to do that. And draw needs to ignore the empty tile. It needs to draw an underscore instead of, or a space. Okay. Is that okay? Okay. So what move does is, well, it would have to check so how many tiles are there around that could potentially be destinations?
Four.
Yeah, there are four. You can't move diagonally in the game of 15, so there are four, left, right, top, and bottom, that we can move to. So presumably we have to check every space, each of those four spaces, to see if we could move there, right? Why do we have to check each of the four spaces? Why can't we just check one? Because we don't know where we're moving, right? Because we don't have the destination, we have to figure out that for ourselves. So the first thing that we have to do is what? In move. We need to do a check to see if it borders an empty space. But before that, there's one thing that this function doesn't get. Some kind of data that the function doesn't get but should get. Yeah? Okay, so it should make sure that the tile exists, but I think we can assume that it does exist. Maybe not. So I think in the main function there's a loop that checks that asks the user for input, and I think in that loop it checks to see if the number is valid. But if not, then you'd have to implement it. That's true. We have to check that the tile exists. But more importantly, we have to check that the tile to locate the tile, right? We have to know the coordinates of the tile to actually access it in the board array, because board is accessed by board ij, where I is the row and j is the column. Okay? So we have to locate the tile first. So how can we locate the tile? The hint is what we were just doing with sort and search. So we actually have to locate the tile using a sort search function, right? Because if we only have the name of the tile, then we have to go looking for that tile to see where it is in the array. Because if we don't have the location of the array, then we can't check to see if the left, right, and top and bottom are empty, right? We can't check that with using only a tile name, because these tiles move. So what we first want to do is to find out the location. And we can do that using a linear search, if you want to go that way. There might be other ways to do it. Can anyone think of one? I mean, I can't at the moment. But there might be other ways. The linear search is certainly the easiest to implement, because it uses the same two loops that we've talked about. So so once we've checked the location, then we can check the each of the four tiles around it, right? How can we do that? So let's say we located the tile in board ij. How can we check that the top is empty?
Just like j -1 and j+1.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So we can do that by, if we have board ij, then we can check that the top is correct by board ij minus 1. Board I minus 1, j. And that the bottom is correct by board I plus 1, j. And the left is correct by board I, j minus 1. That the right is correct by board I, j plus 1. Okay? And we have to make sure that that the tiles actually exist in those locations, because if we were at the leftmost column in the array, then we might end up reading beyond the array. Okay, and that's actually legal C syntax, but it's actually not a very good idea, because you might be reading other people's memory. Okay, and if you see a seg fault or a core dump, that is probably that's probably the reason why your program is crashing. So when you're debugging this problem set, make sure that you've actually checked to see if you're not reading that way, or if you're not reading off the top of the board, or if you're not reading off the bottom of the board. Okay? Because you won't get an error from the compiler. You'll only get it when you run the program. Okay, so once we've located an empty space, we want to move the tile there. So how do we move the tile? Yeah, so do you implement swap somewhere in Lecture or in another problem set? I don't remember. Yeah? No? Okay, so swap will basically be a function that, it doesn't need to be a function. We just want to swap the values of the two tiles, the source and the destination, right? So let's have a temporary variable. Let's call it temp. And we can write int temp equals tile. And then int temp equals the value of the destination tile. So that might be board I j plus 1. It might be board I plus 1 j, you know, depending on our check earlier. Is that clear? Am I making sense? Okay. So we've got the location of the tile that we want to move to. So we can refer to that location and then get the value of the tile at that location, the tile that's blocking our way. And then we can read the value into our temporary variable. And then we can write the tile name that we got in the function into the destination, because we can override that value since we've got a backup of it, right? So, and then in the source tile position, we write back the temporary value. Is that good? Does that make sense? Okay. So if it starts not making sense, then just imagine your tile, and then you are physically just swapping the numbers around. Okay. And this, the part in the air is where we have to have the temporary value, because gravity is going to pull that down. So let's move. So we have to return true if that worked, or false if we didn't find any empty tiles around it. Okay? Is that good for move? Okay, so the last function that we have to implement is one. What does one do? It's actually much simpler than move. So one, the description says, returns true if game is won, i.e. board is in winning configuration, else false. What is the winning configuration? How do you know you've won a game of 15 if you're running it physically?
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, etc. So what we're going to do is basically check all each of the tiles to see if they're in the winning configuration, okay? So it's basically the same two-loop business again. We're looking through each of the tiles and then probably incrementing a counter that tells that goes from 1 to the number of tiles. And then if that counter equals the current value, the current tile that we're looking at, then everything is okay, right? But once the number starts not equaling the counter, then we don't have a winning configuration. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, so one isn't that hard. I guess the most difficult part about the problem set might be move, which is a little complicated because we have to do all that looking at four locations thing stuff. But it's actually not that really complicated when you think about it. So if you do get stuck, then think about the board in a physical way. So don't think about it in an abstract sense. Don't think of it as an array. Just think of it as a numbered table that you've got in front of you. Okay? So does anyone have any questions about anything that I've covered so far? Yes?
So essentially we're uploading a not fully formed .c file and we're filling it in?
So uploading to...
I mean, this thing that we have here, we're going to be able to see this? Or is this something for this?
Oh, yes. So this file, 15.c, and all the other files that I talked about, that I showed you, were a part of the distribution. So when I did the cp-r cs50 pub distributions pset3 to our own home directory, then we copied over the distribution code. Okay? So basically what David has done, he's gone and created this framework for everyone to implement. And he's done that because it's more complicated than the previous problem sets. And it's nice to be able to work with large programs that you've only implemented part of. And that's going to be more important with the next problem set and beyond, because these are they're going to be they're going to be longer problem sets. Okay. All right. So any more questions? If not, then I'll see you next week for walkthrough 4. Thank you.